now, folks, tuck yourself into a little doorway somewhere along Marlborough Street so that you have a decent view of the Abbey for the final installment of our audio walk. This is obviously not the original Abbey Theatre building of 1904. More of that in a moment. Earlier, I described something as happening before the Abbey was even a twinkle in Yeats's eye. For many people, William Butler Yeats is the first person they think of when they imagine Ireland's National Theatre. Yeats was a very talented self-publicist who needs no introduction. But what of the other figures who helped to found the Abbey? How did it all come about? First came the Irish Literary Theatre, founded in 1899 by Yeats, Lady Augusta Gregory, George Moore and Edward Martin. They wanted to create a theatre with a completely Irish repertoire. This had never been done before, provided you ignored half a century of the Queen's Theatre, Dion Boucicault and various other things that definitely happened. Their first production was Yeats's Countess Kathleen at the ancient concert rooms on Great Brunswick Street. They imported their actors from England because, of course, there were no Irish actors that could have played the parts, provided once again that you ignored half a century of the Queen's and various other things that definitely happened. Their initial success was very mixed, and the company performed in a number of different halls around Dublin for several years. The Irish Literary Theatre received a much-needed boost when it merged with the acting troupe of Willie and Frank Fay, a.k.a. the Fay Brothers, thus becoming the Irish National Theatre Society. These lads were inspired by André Antoine's Théâtre Libre in Paris and Ole Bull's National Theatre in Bergen, Norway. The brothers pioneered a new naturalistic style of acting that proved incredibly popular. Frank himself describes it as follows. Our dialogue allows us to talk exactly as Irish peasants talk in a cottage or on the road or in the fields. They instructed others in voice and acting, as well as creating sets, directing the plays and assisting with administration. In short, they were indispensable to the operation. And then came another vital personality, Annie Horniman, a costume designer and tea heiress. She had become friends with Yeats through their mutual interest in the occult. She used part of her vast inheritance to purchase two properties at the corner of Abbey Street and Marlborough Street, the Mechanics Institute and the Old City Morgue. She employed the diarist, historian and theatre critic Joseph Holloway as architect, and the original Abbey Theatre was born. By the time she parted ways with Yeats & Co. in 1910, Horniman had spent more than £10,000 of her personal fortune on Ireland's National Theatre, something like €2 million in today's money. The original Abbey had a proscenium opening of 21 feet. The depth from the curtain to the back wall was 16 feet and the width of the stage from wall to wall was 40 feet. It could accommodate 562 patrons in its cosy horseshoe, and actors used to have to walk along the laneway at the back to go from one side of the stage to the other. The walls were a dark red, often described as the colour of dried mud. Neo-Celtic copper mirrors decorated the lobby, as did paintings of the founder members executed by John B. Yeats. A gong was struck three times to signify the beginning of every play. And what, pray tell, were the first plays performed on opening night in December 1904? Four one-acts. On Balliol Strand by W. B. Yeats, Spreading the News by Lady Gregory, Kathleen Ni Houlihan by Yeats and Gregory together, and In the Shadow of the Glen by John Millington Synge. Gregory's writing was heavily influenced by the ordinary people in and around her home place of Kiltartan, County Sligo. She had transcribed 200,000 words of local folklore before ever creating any work of fiction, which may account for her popularity at the Abbey for many years. Synge's writing, in turn, was influenced by his time on the Aran Islands between 1898 and 1902. Christopher Fitzsimon describes Synge as the figure for whom the Irish literary renaissance had been waiting. And he says that the Playboy of the Western World was the greatest play to come out of Ireland in the 20th century. When it premiered on the 26th of January 1907, it caused quite the sensation. Willie Fay played Christy Mahon and Molly Allgood, a.k.a. Moira O'Neill, played Peggy and Mike. This was the story of a young man who had supposedly killed his father, becoming the darling of a tiny village in the west of Ireland. Yeats was in Scotland at the time, and Lady Gregory sent him a telegram after the first act saying, "Play, great success." Her second telegram was slightly less encouraging. Audience broke up in disorder at the word shift. The last 10 minutes were dominated by boos and hisses. Yates was back in Dublin for the second night. There were boos and hisses from the get-go. Willie Faye threatened to call the police, and six policemen duly turned up. The house lights were turned off at the end, and the audience were plunged into darkness. The third night was the most extreme of all. Yates managed to stoke the flames of public discontent at a press conference beforehand by describing the troublemakers as commonplace and ignorant people with no books in their houses. Crudely speaking, there were two rival factions in the audience that night: nationalists in the pit and drunken Trinity College students in the stalls. These groups taunted each other with rival renditions of God Save Ireland and God Save the King. A drunk Galwayman leapt onto the stage and played an unsteady waltz on the piano. When he threatened random audience members with violence, he was evicted by Singh and the actor playing Old Mahon. Anytime Yates addressed the crowd, a man with a bugle drowned him out. "No man has the right to interfere with another man who wants to hear the play," he said to the strains of the bugle. Lady Gregory's nephew, Hugh Lane, pointed out troublemakers to the police, and the orchestra played jaunty tunes while they were evicted. The Galwaymen managed to sneak back in and cause more mayhem. Audience members shouted, "That's not the West," at Singh's portrayal of Mayo. Others suggested that the policemen present should arrest Christy Mahon. A huge brawl occurred between rival factions on Westmoreland Street afterwards. All in all, it sounds to me like a great night at the theatre. The Fay brothers departed for the USA in 1908 after various disagreements with Yates about the general direction of the theatre. John Millington Synge departed this life in 1909, having finally succumbed to the Hodgkin's disease that had dogged him for years. Annie Horniman withdrew her considerable financial support in 1910 in order to establish the first regional repertory theatre in England. Lady Gregory became the key driving force after the Easter Rising of 1916, as Yates spent more and more time outside Ireland. In 1925, the Abbey became the first theatre in the English-speaking world to receive a state subsidy. Finance Minister Ernest Blythe committed to an annual grant of £850. The following year saw another classic Irish play experience a difficult birth. Sean O'Casey's The Plough and the Stars was the most controversial ticket in town since Playboy. On the night of the 11th of February 1926, a crowd made up of prominent Republican women like Kathleen Clark, Maud Gonne, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, Fiona Plunkett and Margaret Pearse attended the play, a tale of ordinary Dubliners set against the backdrop of the Easter Rising. The audience particularly objected to the character of Rosie Redmond, a prostitute who is soliciting for business while a thinly disguised Patrick Pearse delivers a rousing patriotic speech off stage. For these women, the play was too much too soon. It sullied their vision of the Rising as the great Republican event. There were speeches from the audience. "You have no right to earn your bread by insulting Ireland," they shouted. Coins and lumps of coal were thrown at the players. Barry Fitzgerald, who would go on to win an Oscar, threw a Republican back into the stalls with a punch. Yates decided to remonstrate with the audience as follows. "I thought you had tired of this, but you have disgraced yourselves again. Is this going to be a recurring celebration of Irish genius?" Someone threw a shoe at Yates's head and just missed. The bugler of 1907 was sadly absent. Another great night at the theatre. The Plough and the Stars, like Playboy of the Western world, went on to become one of the most successful Irish plays of all time. As Patrick Carney put it, "In Ireland, a cause never seems to succeed until it meets with palpable opposition, because in Ireland, apathy kills, and opposition supplies the necessary invective for ultimate success." The next major opposition that threatened the Abbey's success was the Fire of July 1951. It started in one of the dressing rooms, spread quickly, and destroyed hundreds of scripts and precious costumes going back years. Brave passers-by managed to fight their way into the lobby to save the John Yates paintings of the founders. This was the beginning of the Abbey's famous exile across the Liffey at the Queen's. And it's how we ended up at the building you see before you now. Architect Michael Scott was chosen to design the new Abbey. Scott had enjoyed moderate success as an actor under the stage name Wolf Curran before turning to architecture full-time. He called the building a concrete renunciation of tradition. And the official opening happened 15 years to the day from the fire. The windows that you can see now on the first floor were only added later. Some of the older actors were disappointed with Scott's renunciation of the tradition of being able to hear what was being said on stage. The new management had to employ a voice coach because the space suddenly required a lot more voice than the Queen's or the old Abbey. This person's first recommendation was to avoid smoky places like pubs, something that upset the older actors even more. And so this is the space that we call our National Theatre today. The Abbey has actually purchased the two riverfront buildings on the other side of the lane, so there's hope that it will soon have the kind of public space it so badly lacks. And of course, the Abbey is still very much a site of contestation, like many of the theatres we've encountered on this audio walk. One of the most vital contestations in recent times was the so-called Waking the Feminists movement from 2015 to 2016. When the Abbey announced its programme for the 100th anniversary of the 1916 Rising, there were 10 plays, but only one of them was written by a woman. What began as an online backlash morphed into a tremendously effective grassroots campaign to tackle the chronic underrepresentation of women in Irish theatre. There was a historic public meeting at the Abbey Theatre on the 12th of November 2015, followed by further meetings on Nollaig na Mban and International Women's Day. 10 leading arts organisations were compelled to create solid gender equality policies. The Irish Theatre Institute published a hard-hitting report that put the issue firmly in the media spotlight. From 2006 to 2015, only 12% of the plays produced at the Abbey were written by women, and only 19% were directed by women. What's seen can't be unseen. The history of Dublin theatre continues to unfold. And that brings us to the end of our walk, folks. For today, in any case. Look, if we'd had more time, we could have perhaps visited the Gaiety, the Gate, Bewley's Café Theatre. Another day. Thank you very much indeed for listening. A walk through Dublin theatre history is brought to you by Dublin Theatre Festival. The 2021 festival runs from September 30th to October 17th with in-person and live-streamed events. If you've enjoyed this tour and would like to support the future of live theatre or become a friend of the festival, please visit dublintheatrefestival.ie. The festival is principally funded by the Arts Council, grant-aided by Dublin City Council, Fáilte Ireland and Be Spectactive. Co-funded by the Creative Europe programme of the European Union. The festival is further supported by the Irish Times, RTE Supporting the Arts, Olitico, Trinity City Hotel and Blackwater Distillery. Recorded at the Podcast Studios, Dublin.